As you pass from sunlight into darkness and back again every hour and a half, you become startlingly aware how artificial are thousands of boundaries we've created to separate and to define. And for the first time in your life, you feel in your gut the precious unity of the earth and all the living things it supports. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, a little over 53 minutes from CFB Uplands at the top speed of the Spitfire Mark 1 in London, Ontario, Canada. Tonight, to complete our second season, we've got a special treat just for you. Raymond Francis will be speaking with retired Canadian astronaut Bjarni Tryggvason, these days an avid flyer and a professor here at Western. It is an honor to be able to speak with someone who, like the author of our opening quote, Apollo astronaut Russell Rusty Schweikart, has had a unique perspective on our Earth. Dr. Tryggvason's accomplishments are too extensive for me to list here, and I hesitate to keep you long from his words. However, allow me one brief digression. One of the most famous and oft-quoted poems in all of space travel is John Gillespie McGee Jr.'s High Flight. Written in 1941, while serving with the Royal Canadian Air Force, McGee was inspired by his view looking down at our planet from over 30,000 feet. Though only the first and last lines are typically quoted, allow me to let the full sonnet speak for itself. Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter's silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of, wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence, hovering there. I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've topped the windswept heights with easy grace, where never lark or even eagle flew, and while with silent, lifting mind I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God. Accompanying us tonight is James Horner's composition, Apollo 13.
So, Dr. Tryggvason, most of our audience will probably be familiar with your name from your flight on the space shuttle in 1997. But your involvement with that mission had a lot to do with your work in space systems engineering, as I understand.
Flew in my capacity as an astronaut payload specialist, but I was actually involved a great deal in developing the hardware that we flew on that flight and the science that we were doing on that flight. And, half of the flight was devoted actually to testing these isolation technologies that we were developing, and I led that whole development. And then the other half was using the isolation systems to do experiments in fluids in the free-fall environment of space.
Okay, so what are these isolation systems? What do they do?
Well, the isolation systems are there to isolate the experiment from the vibrations on the spacecraft. And people think of space as being this perfect, disturbance-free environment. It's not.
You're not just floating freely.
Well, you're floating freely, and as long as you're floating freely, and if you float your experiment, then it would not feel the disturbance of the spacecraft. But things like the space shuttle and the space stations, these are large spacecraft, and there's fans on there, and there's pumps on there, and there's motors on there, and these things drive vibrations through the spacecraft. And on the space station, it has something like 4,000 dynamic modes below 15 hertz, and tens of thousands of modes higher than that. And all these disturbances, whether it's the air conditioning system, the cooling system that takes the heat out of the inside of the labs, transfers it to the solar, well, the radiators on the outside, these are fluid flow systems. Motion of the astronauts, operation of the equipment, all of those things cause disturbances. And so the spacecraft is always vibrating. So the isolation systems will basically float in an electromagnetic, well, it's a magnetic levitation system. Will float your experiment away from that, still make it track the very low frequency motion of the station, but isolate your experiment from these vibration levels. And the vibration levels are peaks of the order of millig's. They're not these micro-G's you keep hearing about. They're millig's, and they can be quite large and have the specific fans they have that have very high peaks of specific frequencies.
So millig's, you're talking like a thousandth of the 1G that you'd feel,
right,
on the
thousands
earth.
Thousands of the 1G. Those are the vibration levels. Now, I still see small. With our hands, we can feel in the 5 to 10 millig range. So if this table is vibrating, you can feel that. Well, it's just below that, just below what we can feel. But we can certainly see it on the fluids experiments. And what we're isolating is taking it from a millig level down to about 25 micro-Gs. So we knocked it down by almost a factor of 1,000. And so now you get a very quiet environment for your experiment. And that's what we're trying to take advantage of for doing these fluid science experiments.
Now, is that just from passive isolation using the magnetic fields?
No, it's an active system. It has these very powerful permanent magnets on the floater side, and then voice coils, and we track the relative position of the floater compared to the base, and we track the accelerations of the floater, and we have a fairly complicated active feedback system to control it, running at about 1,000 control cycles a second, and a mixture of position-based control and acceleration-based control. And so we can drive the performance of the isolation a lot more than if you just had one or the other.
So it's constantly tracking the position and the acceleration of the floating element.
Yeah. And then running currents through the voice coils to take out the vibrations and still have the thing tracking where the space station goes or the space shuttle. Because the space station in each orbit loses, and I forget the number, it's like 15 meters in altitude every orbit, different the drag on the space station.
Right.
And so if you didn't track that follow, then you'd bang into the wall.
Right.
You'd bang into the wall within 1 minute if you didn't track it. And so the low frequency part tracks the station, and then we get rid of the high frequency part through this active isolation system.
Okay,
and it's a no contact isolation system. Everything is. We do an umbilical that we designed to be very, very flexible, but basically it's a kind of a no contact isolation. So we do this, and you get very quiet environment on the floating side.
Okay, so you mentioned that this is in particular for fluid science experiments. Why is it important in that application?
The main experiments we were doing there was in diffusion, and so if you think about what happens in fluids, you get heat transfer. You get mass transfer through diffusion. And those things depend on the thermal state of the fluid. And part of the thermal state is the vibration levels. And so if you're planning your experiment, say a diffusion-controlled experiment, and people have for many years, tried to grow crystals in space, protein crystals, and they're trying to get a diffusion-controlled thing, but they're using diffusion coefficients based on experiments from the ground. Those don't work anymore in the free fall environment.
Because of these small disturbances?
Well, because it's hard on the ground to separate diffusion, which is kind of ground motion, molecular scale activity going on, mass transport, heat transport, from convective activity. And on the ground, convection is much stronger than in space. go to space in a free-fall environment, convection is suppressed by a factor of 1,000 at least. And so now you get the pure diffusion going on much more. Only we've never done enough experiments to understand what it is in the free-fall environment. And these experiments that we did, and we did them both on my shuttle flight, but we also flew experiments on the Russian space station Mir for 2 years looking at diffusion in liquid metals. And we get similar significant decreases in the measured diffusion coefficients of those experiments as we did in the Brownian motion experiment.
Okay. And so this, if you didn't have that active isolation system, then what's the effect on these kind of experiments? Can you do them, or do you just get poorer data?
You can do them, but you're going to get poorer data. And in fact, you get diffusion coefficients that are actually similar to what you see on the ground. And so you sort of wonder, well, why is that? Well, typical vibration levels in a building, if we were to put an accelerometer on the pavement of this building, you would see millig vibration levels. They're just below what you and I could feel. So unless you measure them with sensitive equipment, you wouldn't even know they're there. But they're there. And we've done lots of those measurements too. And so you have similar vibration levels in a typical lab as you would have on the space station, the space shuttle.
So you're not getting this microgravity that you would hope for?
No, that whole term, people thoroughly misunderstand what that is. You know, you hear this term, there's no gravity in space. Well, how would the spacecraft stay in orbit if there's no gravity?
Of course, yeah, from the gravity of the
Earth. Yeah, the gravity is an acceleration in these low Earth orbit. It's just about the same as it is here. Here is 9.8 meters per second square. Up there is 9 meters per second square. It's not zero gravity. And I always get frustrated when you hear people from NASA, Canadian Space Agency, and the European Space Agency, and other astronauts talking about, oh, there's no gravity in space. I go, what physics did you guys learn?
Yeah, of course.
So gravity has not disappeared. Right? The disturbances that we see here are not due to gravity. They're because we have a floor that is exerting a force stopping our equipment from being in free fall. And when it does that, it builds a stress level and hydrostatic pressures, and those are kind of built in everything around us here. When you go into the free fall environment and you are accelerating at 9 meters per second squared in that environment, everything's accelerating exactly the same, or close to the same. And so all that stresses, internal stresses in components, hydrostatic pressures are gone. And so convective flow in fluids has been suppressed by about a factor of 1,000 because the hydrostatic pressures have been reduced by a factor of that order. When you talk about this microgravity business, most people who use that term don't have a clue what they're talking about. They really don't. What it is compared to ideal perfect free fall, which is an acceleration of 9 meters per second squared, that's free fall near the Earth. There is a drag on the space station. It's about a 1 micro G drag. So if you were, say, at the back of the space station and you floated freely inside the lab space, you would accelerate compared to the station because there's no drag on you. And there's a drag on the station. The station is slowing down compared to you. And it's an acceleration. And so you're going to accelerate and go faster and faster inside the space station until you run into the wall at the end.
It's like sitting in a car with the brakes on, but very lightly.
That's right. Yeah. And so it's about a 1 micro G acceleration or drag load on the space station. There's a gravity gradient because the station is in orbit defined by its center of mass. Well, there's parts of the station that are 70 meters away from that. They're trying to be in a different orbit.
Mm-hmm.
In order to force them to come with the center of mass, again, there's a stress built up by the station. It's small, but it's still there. And, you know, if you look at what the heck can a micro G do, the gravitational acceleration at Pluto is 0.35 micro G's. Given enough time, that takes Pluto from being 5 billion miles on one side of the sun to being 5 billion miles on the other side of the sun. That's what a micro G does. No, it takes it about 140 years to do that, but that's what it does. And in terms of time scales of minutes and things, micro G accelerations will move things by centimeters.
Right.
So if you have a fluid cell that's centimeters in size, over time scales of the order of hundreds of thousands of seconds, you will see convection activity going there. And that's why convection is decreased by about a factor of 1,000 compared to here. It's not eliminated. And so if you don't account for that in experiments, the experiments don't work in this idealistic way that a lot of people think they should work. So we were looking at those effects, trying to understand some of those kind of effects on the fluids, particularly looking at diffusion driven by Brownian motion, which is the thermal energy in the fluid. And we got some interesting results there. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to go back and validate those, which we really need to do.
So are there opportunities to do this kind of thing on Space Station now?
There are, unfortunately. It's very difficult to actually get anything up on Space Station. It's a really a complex operation driven by all sorts of drivers, few of them science, unfortunately.
Okay.
And so it's really hard to get through that whole maze of getting their equipment on there. I'm actually looking at trying to fly something on the Chinese space station.
Oh, really?
I'm working with the Chinese on a couple of things lately, and they're open to actually fly an experiment like this. We'll see when the proposal goes in, whether it has any better chance to fly. But I'm going to put in a proposal to fly it on a Chinese space station, because they haven't succeeded in getting support for flying this very fundamental physics experiment again through the ISS space station bureaucracy.
Okay. So along with vibration, which it might be a surprise to think that you have to address that in space, along with that, what are some of the other challenges of that space environment that press on the designers to give difficult and different solutions?
Designing hardware to operate up there, the first thing you have to do is get it up there. And the acceleration loads and the vibration loads during launch are very high. The actual sort of steady-state acceleration load on the shuttle was only like 3 Gs max, which is not very high. But on top of that is a 7 G RMS vibration in all directions. And so you're looking at peak loads of the order of 25 Gs, random vibration in all directions. So that's the main challenge designing your hardware. It has to survive the launch. Once you survive that, the rest of its life is really peaceful. Because while there's these vibrations on station, they're very low level. And we're trying to understand what happens on the science side when you have that free fall. So the rest of the stuff is easy. You have to worry about, from the engineering point, you have to worry about thermal design of all your hardware. Because on the ground here, we have convection curves. So if you turn your radio on or this tape recorder, your cell phone, anything like that, there's always air currents taking the heat away from the system. If you do that in space, there's no or much less convection going on.
There's no density-driven convection.
Yeah. Well, it's really hydrostatic pressure-driven convection currents. Because you're in free fall, there's none of those currents. And so your heat just stays there, and the only way for it to get out is conduction through still air. Air is a very good insulator.
Right.
And so if you are using, say, a watt in this tape recorder, it'll overheat. Is everything you have to be able to design it to make sure you get the heat out of your system. And the space station itself has fluid cooling loops internally. So all the racks and all the equipment are on cooling plates that have fluids running through them, water. And then that goes through a heat exchanger on the outside as a free-out fluid cooling loop. And all the heat is picked up and shoveled outside and radiated to space. And so you have to design your hardware to somehow control the heat thing. Get it into these cooling loops. You have to worry to some extent about radiation issues on your electronics, because there is a higher radiation level. These are particles from the sun, from cosmic rays. They hit us here on the ground as well, but the atmosphere protects us from a lot of them.
Right.
So up there, you're much more susceptible to radiation hits. It's not a real big issue. Like, you can send hardware up there and it's going to work for years. Computers may take the odd glitch, reboot them, get on with your life kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that causes failures, but it may cause interruptions once in a while. So you have to worry about that. So if you're trying to run something for a long, long time, you have to worry about those kind of things. Getting power to your systems. you know, the space station has large solar cells for getting power, but there's not an excess of power. So you have to try to design everything for low power consumption.
Right. And of course, the more power you use, the more heat you're going to have to reject later.
Yeah, the more heat you're going to reject, but that power is shared by a whole lot of things. And I don't know the split, but it can generate a max of 75 kilowatts, but it doesn't generate anything at nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
And so you look at the average, it could be 30 kilowatts. And that's only when everything is directly towards the sun. And so that power is shared by everybody. So you're not going to have a huge amount of power to do the race. You have to worry about designing to be easy on the power. Operations are really difficult on the space station because, you know, it's in orbit, zips around the world every 90 minutes. And so your ability to communicate with it is limited. And in fact, there's only about 50% of the time do you have communication with the space station. The communication goes through these satellites called TETRAS. I think it's telemetry and data relay satellites. And there's three of them in orbit around geosync orbits. And so the station talks to those, and they talk back down the ground. But you may be communicating, say, with one over the Pacific that has to send it to the one over the Atlantic that sends it to the station and then back to where you go. And so there's a bit of a bottleneck in how much communication you have going back and forth. And again, it's shared by everybody. So if you're doing something like trying to track your clouds kind of thing where you take huge amounts of data, you start having a problem getting the data back through that bottleneck. So you have to think about how do you run your experiment so you don't become a huge data hog trying to get your data back down to the space station. That was less of a problem when the space shuttle was servicing the space station. And a lot of the equipment that's on the space station was designed on the assumption the shuttle is there to service your data. So there's all sorts of onboard recording systems, almost no limit to what you can take in terms of the amount of data, because the shuttle could bring it back.
You just carry it back on a hard disk.
Yeah, you just carry it back on a hard disk. Well, shuttle's not there anymore. The Russian Soyuz spacecraft can bring three people and a few pencils. That's it. So you just all of a sudden, we don't have a means for getting huge amounts of data down because of the shuttle shutdown. The Dragon spacecraft that SpaceX is building, that's going to solve some of that problem because it can actually take cargo to the space station and it can bring it back.
Yeah.
Trying to run your experiment, you're on the ground. There's very little crew time available for operating a lot of experiments up there. It's more they can set it up, turn it on, hopefully it runs on its own.
Yeah, the six crew are pretty busy.
Yeah. But if you're on the ground trying to run your experiment, you have at best 50% communication coverage shared by who knows how many other people. So you have to think about how are you going to manage that experiment, make it run so it's automated, get you enough data back and the little snippets you can get at that you can tell it's okay. So that you have to think through that issue of how you do that. And you know, the isolation system that we have on the space station now is in the European Fluid Science Lab. And again, it was designed when shuttle was going to be there to bring stuff back. It's got half a dozen cameras for taking data from fluids experiments. You can't get the data back.
Yeah, it's a really
challenging management problem.
Yeah.
And you know, it's really unfortunate because you spent all this money on this fluid science lab and you can't get your data through the system. So there actually reason like not using it after, I don't know, $100 million in expenditure or something. So there's those logistics issues. The astronauts, you know, they have a certain amount of time to devote to starting experiments or running or whatever, but not a lot. So.
Right.
It's a real problem.
So part of your role here at Western is in teaching, and you teach a course in space systems design.
Yeah.
How do you impress on undergraduate students in engineering the special requirements that the environment imposes?
Yeah. Well, I was kind of lucky in my role at the space agency, or my prime role was as an astronaut. I actually ended up developing science teams, designing hardware, and ended up designing a lot of hardware. I flew some of it on the Russian space station, some on the space shuttle, and some on the space station. And so I learned a lot about what you have to do to design all this hardware. And I flew a satellite on the space shuttle with Steve McLean's flight. That was the first thing I ever did. I'd never seen a satellite before. And all of a sudden I was designing and building one. I had to build it. Other people built it. But I led the team that built that satellite. So I had to learn all the things that you have to do from the engineering point of view, designing these, getting through all the safety issues, launch loads, things like that. Modeling all of how the satellite's going to behave and how your systems behave. So I had to go through that. So what I do with my students here on the Space Systems Design course, I give them a task to design a space system of some kind. And the first 2 years, we designed a lunar rover and started in 1 year and then continued on the next year with the next group of students to continue on with the design. And we built the mock-up. The next year, had to design a transit spacecraft that would take the lunar rover from Earth orbit to orbit around the moon. And again, we got to the point that gets into what we call preliminary design stage. So you've got everything worked out. You haven't done the detailed design yet. And then the last 2 years, we've had them working on designing a rocket. And this is working with a local company here. That the fellow that owns it is a rocket enthusiast, and he'd like to build a rocket to launch these into orbit. And so he had already built a large engine with 60,000-pound thrust. So I had them design a rocket that matched that engine. And then last year they designed the second stage engine. And we actually built that engine. And we've done most of the flow tests through it. It uses liquid oxygen and alcohol as fuel. And we've done most of the flow tests. And we do all the FEM analysis, designed it for these launch loads, designed it for what it has to do. And in this case, it generated the vibration for the rocket. And they had students work on designing a sounding rocket body for that small engine. The small engine is 8,000 pounds thrust. So I take them through, here's what we need to design. And then as we go through the course, I take them through all the different analysis stages you have to go through. So by the time you've completed your design, you've taken through all the different analysis. And that's launch vibrations, thinking about thermal design, you have to worry about that there. On the space side, you have mechanisms and things, how are you going to operate them, and how are they going to operate in the free fall environment, and in the vacuum environment, and so on. So I take them through a design process like that.
And it's interesting that you can teach that process with such diverse projects, with the rover, with the transiting spacecraft, with the rocket, and still give them the same kind of experience that they need.
Yeah, any of those. They all need the same type of analysis. They all need to survive the launch. That's the worst thing that happens to them.
Right.
Huge vibrations. And you know, like if this table beside us here were vibrating those loads, it would be a blur a half an inch thick.
Yeah.
Like when you see it, you just freak out. How can anything survive that? But it can't. And it's not difficult. You just have to go through the proper analysis to make sure it's designed to survive that. But it's amazing how much vibration this stuff goes through. So all of us have to go through that. Things like the spacecraft, there's more thermal issues you have to worry about. Your electronics has to typically work at what we normally call room temperature.
Yeah.
Something between 0 and 50 degrees centigrade. You can go down to minus 40 for some electronics, up to 85 for some. Well, the external surface of your spacecraft is facing the sun, wants to go to 200 degrees centigrade. The part of the spacecraft facing space wants to go to minus 200 degrees centigrade. So you've got to do a thermal design to make sure your electronics is in a temperature range where it's happy. And so you have to take them through that. So that applies to the rocket, that applies to the spacecraft, that applies to the lunar rover. The lunar rover has to survive the landing on the moon. And we were basically using some of these airbag approaches as our sort of baseline. So from that, you can model the collision, what it is, what's the stresses, design the structure to survive that, design the instrumentation inside to survive that. Surface of the moon is about 100 degrees centigrade in the sunny side and minus 140 on the shady side. We can survive the 100 degrees centigrade. It's a little hard to survive the minus 140. And mainly the issue is batteries. How do you get batteries to survive that?
Right.
So that's a real difficulty. Anyway, so just take them through all those different things you have to go through. We don't necessarily cover exactly the same thing every course, because in a 4-month course you can't. So we cover the elements that are relevant to the particular design project they're working on.
So then, aside from teaching, what about some of your current projects that you're working on? What are you doing these days?
Well, the main thing I'm doing is after I retired from the space agency, I made the great mistake of starting a company.
So. Okay.
And that company does electronics. We do very high performance data acquisition and control electronics. And that came out of the electronics we had to develop for these isolation systems. They were very high performing electronics. And we had to develop those because we couldn't just buy the kind of stuff we needed off the shelf. So we developed how to build all that electronics. And you know, I sort of scoped out the system design for that electronic systems and the control system we had to put in, and then I had really smart people actually building it. But we designed some pretty neat ways of doing this electronics. And so I've taken that and just for various things that just happened, took that and developed much more compact electronic systems that give me this 1,000,000-to-1 measurement resolution, very wide dynamic range in terms of frequency, and so I can run very sophisticated control systems and very high quality measurements on that. And so I started a company to see whether I could make that work, and it's been going for a few years now. And we're still struggling with it, but you know, it's getting there. We're getting good sales, and we have some really good engineers that work with me on that company. So that occupies most of my time, and one of the projects that we're going to be doing is actually with a university in China.
Mm-hmm.
That they're interested in some of the isolation work, some of the control system work. So I'm going to be doing some work with them if we find all the right ways to make it all come together. This is probably going to be that's good. And if that occupies most of my time. I also fly my aerobatic airplane.
Mm-hmm.
That occupies most of my weekends. And both myself and my son fly this thing. We actually have two different airplanes. And we fly competition aerobatics and those things. So
okay.
It takes up the free time that no longer exists in my life.
Right.
Yeah.
So how about astronautics and spaceflight? Are you still in touch with that community?
I don't do a lot in the space world anymore, although I'm going to be doing some work with these folks in China. Just because the company, like the electronics, came out of what I did in the space program,
mm-hmm.
but we really focus on terrestrial applications of the electronics in labs and in industrial use and things like that. So I don't do a lot. I'm still interested. So I come to these CPXS meetings, you know.
Right.
Still interested. I'm working with a company here, Stein Industries, where the fellow is interested in building rockets with the idea of launching them. And so I support that work. Most of the work is done at the company. But I'll, again, do a lot of the engineering analysis, thinking about how we need to do it, get the students to help work on that, and then help provide some guidance to the testing I think they have to do on those engines and make sure that all the analysis is done completely. And so you know before you build the thing, it's going to work.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe just to wrap up then, do you have any thoughts on where we stand now with the Human Spaceflight Program and where you hope it'll be going in the next years?
Well, you know, the manned flight spacecraft program in the States is really in a bit of a tough bind. And it's unfortunate. Like the space shuttle, I think, was one of the most amazing machines that people have ever built. You know, it's a rocket ship to get you into orbit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a spacecraft. You could be up there for really a longer shuttle flight, for 17 days or something. And then it comes back in as a reentry vehicle, world's biggest, fastest, longest gliding glide.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing vehicle. And it could take 40, 50,000 pounds of cargo up, and it could bring back 20, 30,000 pounds of cargo back. Nothing else can do that. And we're not going to see anything that can do that for the next 50 years.
Yeah.
And so there's a capability that has been taken out of the program. Those decisions were made by George Bush, And I think they were very unfortunate decisions. And like the whole space program, the space station, the space shuttle, going back to the moon, how are you going to build on that, was all really all thought through. But it was building on those programs. And all of a sudden, poof, it's changed.
Right.
Shut down this program, the shuttle program. They wanted to shut down the space station as well. And weren't able to because it was an international program. And now we're on this, developing this big rocket and these crew exploration vehicle. But the missions for them have not been thought through. So how do you do an $18 billion development and you haven't really thought, what are you going to do with this stuff? So I think the program on the NASA side is unfortunately a little bit of limbo. Not quite sure where it's going to go. Some of the planetary probes, amazing success there.
Yeah.
So on that side, I think there's enough input from the science community and the people that know what they're doing there that that's in really good shape. And I think the stuff we're getting from Mars and this latest lander on Mars, pretty amazing developments. And I think we'll see a lot of good science come out of that. On the manned side, it's just a little bit fuzzy as to what's going to happen. I think it'll recover.
Yeah.
And I think developments like the Falcon 9 and Dragon through SpaceX.
Right.
I mean, they are looking at manned raiding that and taking people up in the Dragon. It'll take them a few years, but hopefully it'll happen. There's two or three other developments in the U.S. where people are looking at building vehicles to get people into orbit. I don't think they're all going to be able to go to completion because there just isn't enough to have three different vehicles taking people to orbit.
Right.
That doesn't make any sense. So there'll be a shakeout in there, but hopefully one of those privately developed vehicles will work and we'll start using those to go to the space station and to support where we go. So I think it'll recover from this limbo land we seem to be in these last few years. And certainly the manned program is not going to go away. People think that shutting down the space station or space shuttle meant the end of the manned space program. Not at all. There was no decrease in budgets. It was shut down this program and try to do it in some other way. It wasn't shut it down. Space station is going to be up there until 2020, and they're already talking about extending that to 2028 or something. And I think it'll extend that far. And if we sort out and streamline how to operate the station, how to get science up there, I think we'll see some good work. But we're not at that point yet.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to us. And good luck with all of your work with electronics and rocket ships and students. And
airplanes.
Everything, yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All keep me very busy.
Yeah.
But enjoying it.
Well, that's the way to go, right?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
You are listening to Western Worlds. On astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just heard the interview with Dr. Tryggveson talking about a whole survey of different things that he's done during his career, working in space, working on the ground for space, and for other things. I certainly enjoyed the variety of activities he's got to do in the last 20-odd years.
I really liked his one part of the interview where he actually talks about how we considered ISS to be a quiet place up there, you know, in the space, but it's actually not. It turns out that the astronauts go through a lot. Not only astronauts, but even the, you know, the machines that are working there, the experiments that we actually send there have to be tested in a way. They need to be thermoshield.
Mm-hmm. Vibration tested.
Yeah, vibration tested. And also the fact that it's zero gravity there. They have to go through a lot of... I really like the whole idea of how it's not quiet there. They have a lot of vibrations, a lot of noise from all the fans, machines. I would expect it to be a quiet place up there.
Yeah, well, in the interview we talked about the sources of those vibrations, but of course we also don't really have sinks for that energy, right? Here on the Earth, the building vibrates because there are fans and things, but it's connected to a planet that weighs a whole lot more than the building and can damp out and take away some of that energy. The space station is not connected to much of anything, so you're not going to lose that. It has to be dissipated as heat eventually.
Speaking of space environment, one particular thing that he explained really well is the concept of microgravity. Usually we tend to think in space because we're so far from the Earth, it appears that there's no gravity, but we tend to think there's some sort of little like microgravity, but it's actually microgravity is just the drag on space station due to the outer atmosphere. And then because you're inside a space station and you're floating inside, but the space station is slowing down with respect to you, so you're actually accelerating towards the other end of the space station. So in a way that acts like a microgravity environment.
Yeah, it's a concept about which there is a lot of confusion, partly in the physics of it and partly in the terminology, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's not a big fan of the term microgravity, but it's the one that seems to have become kind of the official nomenclature. I used to work in a directorate of human spaceflight and microgravity, to the irritation of some of the people who were doing weightless experiments there.
I know I've heard him talk to students as well, and he gets very upset with the term zero gravity, too, because it's not, you're not in zero gravity, there's gravity there. It's just you happen to be in a free fall constantly.
That's right, and as he points out very correctly, the space station is in orbit of the Earth because of gravity.
Yes.
So you're feeling something like 90% of the gravitational force you would feel on the surface of the Earth.
And when he said that it feels like you're constantly in a car that has brakes applied, and when I thought about that, I was like, oh, because that just... Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever been in a car where it's slowing down so smoothly that when it actually stops, you can't actually tell that it stopped, and so you're still in that, you know, braced position, and you just want to relax, you know, when the car actually stops. And so being in that kind of constant physical state would be very difficult.
The good thing about the ISS is that acceleration is very slight. It's
right.
Like milli-g's. But nonetheless, yeah, that's the environment that you're in, and that's what the isolation experiments, like the one in the fluid science lab, have to deal with. It is unfortunate, as you pointed out, that some of that lab equipment, they're struggling to make use of it. But fortunately, at least the fluid science lab, they've got two experiments complete so far. It's less than 100% use of the time, but they've nonetheless got some experimentation time.
What kind of experiment have they done?
Planetary science, in fact.
Ooh.
Yeah, believe it or not. Experiment Geoflow 1 and Geoflow 2 ran. I actually worked a little bit on Geoflow 1 when I was at ESA. Basically, they're trying to model the fluid flow inside the core of the Earth, in the liquid core, or in the viscous mantle between the core and the crust. A spherical shell suspended in a weightless environment, that's what the Earth basically is, using cameras and interferometry and things, trying to understand how the flows happen in that kind of environment. The second version of Geoflow just finished a couple months ago.
That's good that it's being used.
Yeah, so there's some science happening, I think.
Yeah, that's good.
Despite the very difficult environment that they have to work in, he described just how surprising that environment is, but also how you have to impress that on students and on young engineers, and how to get them to think about this exotic place that you're working in and the exotic and difficult cases that you have to think about and the requirements you have to put into your designs. It's a real challenge.
Mm-hmm. I also find it how fascinating it's for people to go into space, but it is not an easy place to live. It's not everyday things. You just don't get up and brush and go on with your day, right? It's strange to even, like, just drink. Just have, like, tea kettle going on while you're brushing your teeth, humming songs while, you know. It's not easy. It's pretty difficult. And what I love about all the ESRA interviews is how enthusiastic they are about this whole idea of living up there. While I would personally think it would be very difficult and very discouraging for me to go just to a completely new weightless environment.
Yeah, and as hard as it is for humans, try to imagine designing a machine to work in that environment. Let's suppose that you want to deliver some fluid to an experiment, a little bit of water, insert some water into that experiment cell. Well, it's not going to flow downhill.
Mm-hmm. Or even something as simple as using a screwdriver or something like that. The low impact cordless tools that were invented for the use of the space missions.
Also a pen too. They had to reinvent pen.
Yeah.
Because there's way less the pen, the ink in the pen, it won't actually flow down. You have to invent some kind of mechanism that injects the ink.
Which is something you would never really think about. Or at least I wouldn't. And then you're up there going, damn it, why won't my pen write?
Yeah.
But then you, I guess, like for me, I just take pencil. I don't know. But that's cool that there are space pens.
Yeah. There are things that you don't even think about on the ground. You know, he mentioned during the interview the fact that disparate parts of the space station are, as he puts it, trying to be in different orbits because they're 100 meters apart from each other.
Right.
And left to their own devices, they drift apart, which means there are stresses in the structure that come from the basics of orbital mechanics. You have to think about those things when you're designing a structure. You don't have to deal with that when you're making a bridge. You just have one G field down all the time. That's it. It's a real challenge to get those things working, to consider all those cases. And this is part of what they have to think about when they look at extending the space station out for another 10 or 18 years.
Another thing that was interesting to me was the class that he teaches here at Western. So I don't know. I know he didn't get into too many details, but maybe you could tell us about what goes on in that class and kind of the methods for teaching that class. Because, of course, it is a different mindset to be in when you're designing things for space.
As you talked about this, it's a project-based kind of course. They're going to have something that they need to design by the end of the semester. And they won't bring it to a full ready-to-fly-in-space kind of level of design, but they'll bring it up to one of the intermediate stages. And in a course like that, you've got to present all of the different things that you have to consider, the thermal analysis, the vibration analysis, structural, power, these kinds of things. And you'll get the students to first recognize what things need to be considered and then which aspects of the system deal with thermal loads, for example, and apply the things they learned in their earlier year courses to that case. So they have to design analyses that are suitable that they can say will prove that the system works. So thinking about what's necessary, thinking about what's appropriate, and thinking about how to convince yourself that this system will work. So there's that whole design process that they have to work through. And I gather it's been fairly successful. They're working with an industrial partner now. And it's a typical thing that happens in universities that have space engineering kind of programs.
Mm. Well, what I find interesting is, of course, he was an astronaut back in the 80s and 90s when he flew up in the space shuttle. But, of course, now he's teaching at Western and he has his own company. So maybe you can kind of end with talking about what he does with his company.
Astronaut is seen as this career capstone kind of thing, right? A lot of young children want to do that. A lot of older children want to do that. But of course, there's life after you fly in the space shuttle. And one of the things he's done is this kind of spin-off technology. He had to develop some precise control electronics for the isolation systems. And so he's worked that into a kind of commercial venture. And he has some teaching on the side. And when you have experience, it's good to pass it on. So yeah, he's got all kinds of things that he's able to do. What I particularly like about talking with Dr. Trigvason kind of at the end of the season like this, all season we've been hearing about people who are doing exciting and interesting things, studying the way the universe works and doing exciting things in space all over the solar system. The kind of thing that we hear from Dr. Trigvason about how difficult it is to work in the space environment reminds us of just how challenging it is to achieve anything in space. We get something as impressive as we heard throughout the season from the scientists that we spoke to. It sort of helps you appreciate just how challenging it is.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, Varshni Patel, and Zengi Hu. Our editors were Raymond Francis, Michelle Parsons, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight and all season long. Tune in again next year when we'll be back with a whole new set of interviews with luminaries in planetary science and exploration. Until then, I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds right here on astronomy.fm.